This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On Capitol Hill today, Attorney General John Ashcroft, FBI Director Robert Mueller, and Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee on the latest developments in the war on terrorism. And while there was praise all around for the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the alleged operations chief of Al-Qaeda, there were also warnings. Other terrorists are still at large. No one knows exactly who or how or where or when, but most, if not all, of the experts and officials agree that another attack in this country is inevitable. The Department of Homeland Security, just up and running, is designed to prevent attacks if possible, coordinate response in the event, and contain the damage and the casualties. Amid orange alerts, duct tape, and outlining emergency routes, a battle is underway over how the billions designated for Homeland Security are being spent. What are the greatest vulnerabilities? What should the priorities be? And given the fact that no defense can possibly be perfect, how much is enough? In a few minutes, we'll be joined by Senator Patty Murray of Washington, who wants to emphasize the protection of our seaports, and we'll talk with two analysts who've studied the holes in our domestic security and the proposed patches. We also want to hear from you. If you live near a border, has security tightened up? Are power plants and bridges, chemical plants and refineries protected near where you live? What about airports and the performance of the Transportation Safety Administration? And how much of this debate do you think is about politics? To join the conversation, give us a phone call. Our number here in Washington, D.C. is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And joining us now to catch us up to date on Homeland Security spending is Jeff Stein, editor of Homeland Security News at Congressional Quarterly. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
Now, since September the 11th, how much new spending has Congress authorized on Homeland Security, or is there any real way to tell?
Well, there's a lot of authorization, but there's not so much in the appropriations when we get down to a worm's eye view of this. We're going to spend about $40 billion this year on Homeland Security. At the federal level, we're ushering 179,000 employees from 22 agencies into the new Department of Homeland Security. But lest anyone get the wrong impression, 22 agencies are not moving anywhere, and 179,000 employees are not moving to a headquarters in Washington. We're simply subsuming these 22 agencies under Homeland Security. There'll probably be about 1,000 people at headquarters.
Mm-hmm. Now, when this was proposed, one of the ideas was efficiencies of scale. Is that happening in any measurable way?
Boy, that's an ongoing argument. A lot of people think that the White House was right to object to creating a whole new Department of Homeland Security. Their argument for a long time was that we can run it out of the White House, and we'll just do reforms at the INS and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But the Democrats began to make a lot of hay on Capitol Hill with the call for Department of Homeland Security, and so I think politically the White House decided to go with it. But whether there are economies, I think that that's falling back on the old cliche, it's too soon to tell. A lot of the needed carpentry work has been done with the INS, breaking it up and splitting up its functions.
That's the Immigration and Naturalization Service.
Yes, I'm sorry. And overdue reforms on visa controls are being done. We're going to have a better idea next year who's in the country, and we didn't on September 11th.
Now, is there any way to measure the budget for Homeland Security today as compared to September 10th, 2001? I mean, are these things measurable now?
Not really. It's a little bit of apples and oranges. I'd really have to sit down with a calculator to do that because, after all, the largest agencies first responsible for preventing an attack are the FBI, CIA, could argue the National Security Agency, the Pentagon, and they are not in Homeland Security, and they will not be in Homeland Security. Even the new intelligence section that the president proclaimed would be in the Department of Homeland Security is not in the Homeland Security. In effect, it's under the CIA. So when you start moving those dollars around, are those federal Homeland Security dollars? No, but they're related. The same with the state, local, municipal levels. They're spending a lot of money. The spending on Homeland Security by 2005, according to some estimates, however, could be as much as $55 billion. So we're talking a lot of money.
Now, the Bush administration has proposed increasing the budget this year by some 7.6%.
Mm-hmm.
And that's off of last year. And of course, mm-hmm. last year already incorporated increases in spending after September the 11th. And mm-hmm. you can get into a lot of arguments over the numbers.
That's right. Even in the first responder numbers, there's a lot of shell gaming going on here. And pointing of fingers, even the White House has decided to blame their own Republicans on Capitol Hill for not pushing forward the first responders bill. The Republicans on the Hill are very gracefully saying, we understand what the president has to do. But the fact is, very little of that $3.5 billion in first responder money is actually really new money. It's a lot of transfer of money from other existing departments and programs, such as in the Justice Department. Listeners may remember the Clinton program to hire 100,000 police, for example.
Mm-hmm.
That money is moving over into Homeland Security. It's just being given, they're ripping the old label off, crime, drugs, bank robberies, etc., and putting a new label on, calling it Homeland Security. So there's a lot of just moving the boxes around, moving the money around. Having said that, I don't want to say nothing's being done. A lot's being done. There's a lot of movement here. But clearly, this is a work in progress.
Now, both the GAO and the OMB, and that's the Office of Management and the Budget, which works for the White House, and GAO, which the Government Accounting Office, which works for Congress, mm-hmm. they've already put the Department of Homeland Security on their watch list for poor performance, vulnerable, according to the GAO, for waste, fraud, abuse, and mismanagement. Wow, what, it's been up and running for 2 months?
Not only that, I mean, yeah, it's a little unfair. I mean, this is like as if Roosevelt had decided to reorganize the War Department in the year after Pearl Harbor. It makes me very sympathetic to the Bush argument that we should have not tried to create a Department of Homeland Security while we're trying to catch terrorists and, protect the country.
Sounds like your editor's trying to get in touch with you.
Yeah, I'm getting buzzed by a pom-pom, so I'm going to turn it off now. Take it away, Neil.
Well, we're going to repeat the phone number, which is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, TOTN@NPR.org. And let's take a phone call. Adrian joins us from Baton Rouge in Louisiana.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Well, are you waiting for my comment?
Yeah.
I've heard, estimates that 15 to 25% of the world's industrial chemicals are made in Louisiana between Baton Rouge and New Orleans. The chemical plants are virtually everywhere, and virtually everyone has someone in their family or knows people who work in and out of the chemical plants. And there are 10 bridges across the Mississippi River,
mm-hmm.
virtually all of which look down on chemical plants, that are surrounded by roads that everybody can traverse right up next to them. They were not designed to protect against a terrorist attack. There are not large green spaces around them. The people in the chemical plants are extremely well trained in safety procedures, and we have very few incidents that are unsafe. But in terms of evacuation of the population, I think most of the people we deal with and the people I know, when you talk about terrorist attack on chemical plants, I guess the best analogy I can draw is people in Louisiana kind of think about them similar to the way I would assume Californians deal with earthquake. Let's don't think about it. Let's hope it doesn't happen.
Hmm. Jeff Stein, that's not the only vulnerability, but that's got to be an important one.
That's a huge vulnerability, and you know what? Everything's vulnerable. We've got all sorts of strategic problems. We've got the Hoover Dam. I mean, and this really, you've brought up an example that really is the problem or dilemma of Homeland Security in a nutshell. If you have a threat-based analysis, in other words, if you start from the operating principle that you're going to protect the country, you're going to have a bottomless well of spending and still not be secure. After all, Israel is a militarized society and they can't stop suicide bombers. So what have they done? They've put their money into intelligence on the one hand and coping with a disaster on the other. We're not putting enough money into emergency medical care, in my opinion and the opinion of many people. And our intelligence services are just getting off the ground after being asleep for 20 years. So if we want to start with protecting chemicals, to put your go back to your example, we have to actually have legislation which will have someone who will be in charge of protecting chemicals. Senator John Corzine of New Jersey put a bill in the hopper last year to do just that, to have the EPA take on this police function of making sure security was tight at chemical plants. Of course, New Jersey is a huge repository of that. And he had his head handed to him because the chemical industry didn't want to have an unfunded mandate put on them. And EPA cops, if you will, coming around giving them tickets for not having security that could stop a terrorist attack. Now, again, after all, are we going to be able to stop a terrorist with a rocket-propelled grenade who wants to shoot it at a natural gas tanker farm? No, I don't think we can. So we really have to think real hard about what we're doing with national security and homeland security.
Adrian, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Good suggestion. And Jeff Stein, I wanted to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Neil.
Jeff Stein was here in Studio 3A. He's the editor of Homeland Security News at Congressional Quarterly. Joining us now from her office here in Washington, D.C. is Senator Patty Murray from the state of Washington. She's the ranking Democrat on the Transportation Appropriations Subcommittee. Good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Neil, nice to talk to you.
You developed the Port Security Initiative. Why did you focus on ports?
Well, several bipartisan commissions have told us that one of the places we are very vulnerable in this country to a terrorist attack is in our ports. We have millions of tons of cargo. In fact, we have more than 6 million containers that come into our ports in this country every year. And right now, we know very little about what's in them. They are loaded in ports in dozens of cities around the world, some of them in countries that have very little control over what's loaded in them or who's loading them or what kind of protections are put in place. So this is a point of vulnerability that we can and should do something about. That's why I developed the Operation Safe Commerce initiative that would provide funds to begin to put in place systems in our ports so that we know what is coming in and we know that they are secure.
And the vast bulk of that material comes inside sealed cargo containers that nobody can look in right now.
That's correct. And we all know from watching what happened at our airports when we began to slow down and look at every passenger and their suitcase, how long that took and what kind of economic impact it had. It would be far more devastating with containers that come into our countries, that come into our ports, and then are shipped everywhere that people are counting on. If we had to stop every container and look inside it, or even stop every container and x-ray it, we would absolutely stop commerce in this country and cost our country billions of dollars in commerce.
So what kind of program did you want to see in place?
Well, I wrote into my transportation bill an initiative called Operation Safe Commerce that will give grants to our three largest container ports in the country, money to begin to put in place technologies like electronic seals and electronic tracking devices so that we know what is in those containers, where they are loaded, anywhere in the world, and follow them so when they come into our ports, we know that they are secure before they get here, and we can track them with INS and Customs so that they can be loaded and moved through quickly, and we can basically reduce the number of containers that may be ones that are vulnerable.
Would one of those ports, the three largest ports in the country, I have to ask the cynical question, be in the state of Washington?
There's no doubt. Washington hosts the third largest container port in the nation, Seattle-Tacoma. We have tons of commerce that come in from ports from many Pacific Rim countries, and we know that often we have containers coming from terminals that may not be very safe. So absolutely, it's part of it.
Senator Murray, we have to take a short break. Can you stay with us for a minute or so?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Senator Patty Murray is with us from her office in Washington, D.C. When we come back from a short break, we'll continue to talk with her and take more of your questions about the spending on Homeland Security and about whether you see already any benefits from spending that's already underway at borders, in ports, or at airports. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Cohn, and it's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. With us on the line from her office here in Washington is Democrat Patty Murray, a senator from the state of Washington. We're talking about spending on Homeland Security. And Senator Murray, I wanted to read you an email that we received from, and I'm going to pronounce this improperly, I'm sure, but Murdaud from Emeryville, California, who writes, it would have been unthinkable for us not to conduct the massive and careful investigation that we have been conducting for the Shuttle Columbia tragedy, because without finding the root causes, how can we guard against similar tragedies in the future? Without knowing the true sources of terrorism against us, how can we know, for example, that the very things we're doing to combat terrorism today are not inviting more and more people to pick up arms against us? If we're going to spend $400 billion, he writes, and that must be a typo, $40 billion on Homeland Security, I'd like to know what percentage of that will be devoted to funding an independent and comprehensive research on the sources of terrorism against America.
Well, certainly that is a part of the effort that was put in place into this country after September 11th, and no doubt he's right. But the other part of it is we have worked very hard. I just talked a few minutes ago about the Operation Safe Commerce Initiative that I put into place. We funded $28 million that was signed into law last July. We just put $30 million into the appropriations bill today. But you know what? So far, the administration hasn't put $1 of that out to the ports. They have been fighting amongst themselves about who's going to oversee it rather than getting money to the places where we can use it to begin to put in place some of these security measures. And to me, that is a huge frustration.
Well, as you know, the charges of politics have been made both ways. Some Republicans say Democrats are trumpeting this issue and, you know, just trying to make the administration look bad.
Well, I'm not talking about the funding itself. Congress passed this funding. This is one of the areas where we actually have put money into Homeland Security. There are other places where people are charging that the administration isn't putting enough. This isn't about that at all. This is the fact that Congress, on a bipartisan basis, put the money in. The president has signed this, but they have not released any of the money. They are simply sitting on it. And I think this is up to Ridge, now that he is in charge, to crack the whip and tell people, let's get this money out there. Let's start making our ports more secure. That's what I'm concerned about today.
And would seaports, among all of the priorities that we have to worry about, including in your state, of course, border control, but the seaports, you think, are the most important thing right now?
I think there's a number of areas that we need to be concerned about, but certainly when you have 6 million containers coming into our country every day that come from countries like Indonesia, that come from countries where we may not have as much control on them, that is a place where we not only should be making a difference, but where we can be making a difference. These are issues we can get our hands around, but it's a matter of getting the money out there right now, not stalling it, and making sure that those containers are secure when they come in.
Senator Murray, thanks very much. I know you're extremely busy. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Senator Patty Murray speaking with us from her office in Washington, D.C. She's a senator from the state of Washington and a Democrat. Joining us now is Stephen Simon. He's at the Rand Corporation in Arlington, Virginia, and co-author of The Sacred Age of Terror. He was on the National Security Council staff under President Clinton from 1994 to 1999. Welcome.
Hi.
And also with us is Michael Scardeville. He's a Homeland Security Policy Analyst at the Heritage Foundation. He's with us from his office here in Washington by high quality line. And Michael Scardeville, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thanks for having me on.
You both were listening, I'm sure, when Senator Murray was talking about the idea of spending more money on ports and the holdup of the spending of that money. Michael Scardeville, is this something that needs to be resolved very soon?
Well, in many ways, calling the issue the senator was just talking about port security is a misnomer. Our emphasis should not be on the ports when a product finally enters the United States, at what's known as the point of entry. Our emphasis should be, and really has been for many months, on two things. One, gathering better information about cargo containers so we can assess whether or not they present a threat, and then being able to take action early on. The Customs Service, now part of the Department of Homeland Security, is doing this primarily through two programs, one known as the Container Security Initiative, which puts U.S. officials at foreign ports, in fact, most of the major ports that ship products to the United States, in order to work with local officials to conduct inspections at the point of origin, as well as a new ruling that requires shippers to provide manifest information 24 hours before a ship departs in order to give the Customs Service and the Department of Homeland Security and the intelligence agencies in the United States time to assess whether or not that container is a risk or may present a risk so we can take action before it leaves, or monitor it as it's moving across the ocean, or take action once it enters American territorial waters. The actual port facilities in the United States do need some additional protection, but this doesn't have to be primarily a federal role. There is a role for the Coast Guard, there is a role for the Transportation Security Administration, but there's also major steps that have to be taken by the state and local port authorities and the private sector operators. You know, these guys aren't even willing to buy fences in many cases right now, and this should not be a federal government welfare program for local authorities. The federal government should continue to focus mostly on facilitating and from the long-term overseas perspective, but you know, focusing on that final point of entry would be the misguided approach, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Simon, you've, among many, and including Michael Scardaville, talked about the vulnerabilities of the containers, but you've written that you're concerned that the administration's priorities are in the wrong place.
Well, what I have argued, rather, is that the administration, the United States, continues to spend a good deal of money on conventional military capabilities when we need to be doing other things more directly related to the threat of terrorism. Now, turning around age-old patterns of defense spending is extremely difficult. It would be difficult for any administration, Democrat or Republican. These are entrenched programs, and they're defended by advocates, by practitioners, in this case the military, who, for good reasons from where they're sitting, are hard to convince that the conventional threats have actually gone away. And given the fact that we are likely going to be fighting a major land war in Southwest Asia, they probably have a point. In any case, there needs to be substantial spending on homeland security programs that are directly related to the kinds of threats that we have seen emerging, along with the emergence of Al-Qaeda and the jihad movement that brought to us the attacks on September 11th. And in particular, I've argued that we need to have some way to defend ourselves against cruise missiles and unmanned aerial vehicles, like remotely controlled crop dusters that can be used to spread chemical weapons or biological weapons within the United States, and against which we really have no defense. And I also feel strongly that we need to have a defense for civil aviation against the kinds of attacks, for example, we saw in Mombasa.
That's the shoulder-fired missile assault.
That's a shoulder-fired missile, a man-portable air defense missile is what they're called. You often hear them called man pads. They're basically shoulder-fired missiles that can take down an airplane as it takes off or lands from an airport. And we know, unfortunately, that Al-Qaeda, these terrorists, want very much to disable civil aviation. They want to score a big hit. They tried to do this in the 1995-96 time frame, mm-hmm. when they staged a rather elaborate plot that was stopped at the last minute to destroy simultaneously 12 jumbo jets, U.S. jumbo jets, over the Pacific. This is really a priority for them, and the kinds of weapons they would use to do this, these man-portable, shoulder-fired weapons, are all over the place. They're easily available, and they can indeed be used to do this, and they can also be smuggled into the United States for reasons that Senator Murray was referring to. So we need to deal with these problems, but they're very expensive to deal with.
Well, let's get a response on that from Michael Scardaville.
Well, I certainly agree with the notion of providing for cruise missile defense and ballistic missile defense. I think those are important priorities that our Defense Department needs to look at in terms of both traditional defense issues as well as with some homeland security applications. On the issue of protecting civil aviation from man pads or other means of being brought down, I think that a lot of what's been done by the Transportation Security Administration will make life more difficult for a terrorist to bring down a bomb with or plane with a shoe bomb or some other form of explosive smuggled onto a plane. Attempting to bring them down with a surface terror missile, a manhandled surface terror missile, probably would not be very difficult, particularly since it would be relatively easy to smuggle these things, as has been pointed out by the last speaker, and they're pretty widespread. However, to go retrofit the entire American civil aviation fleet to have kind of countermeasures to these weapons would most likely be extraordinarily expensive. I think a better approach here might be to make such systems available for aircraft as airlines procure new aircraft or where they go through their normal upgrade process, instead of, you know, sending out huge block grants that could probably be spent on reforming our intelligence community, providing for intelligence fusion so we can have better access to information and hopefully arrest these guys before they can even get near the airport.
Well, let's get our listeners involved. 800-989-8255. Our next caller is Luke, who's on the line with us from Boston.
How you doing?
Okay.
I had a comment on the fact I was in Heathrow Airport a couple months ago, and I was watching a lot of armed men and tanks and things like that on the airports. And I was wondering, not only for airports, but for port for seaports in America, is that going to be a visible thing that we're, the American society is going to be able to see within the next couple of years in terms of spending huge amounts of money on that, not only for the aviation and the airports, but for also seaports, because there's a huge number, and I agree with both of the commentators today, there's a huge number of things that we are importing to this country that we just aren't, we can't check. We don't have the manpower or the capacity to be able to check that, and I'll take my comments off the air.
Thanks, Luke, very much. Steve Simon, I also saw some of the presence of the forces and the tanks around Heathrow Airport, but also all of the news media delighted in standing around saying, I'm directly under the flight path and you can see nobody around me. Defending against these things is extremely difficult.
Defense is extremely difficult, which is why countermeasures on the airplanes themselves, on the targets themselves, become the best route, in fact, the inevitable and only route to protecting airplanes against the attack by these missiles. They're very difficult to see. It only takes one shooter. The shooters can conceal themselves easily. If you look around the neighborhoods surrounding major airports, there are millions or thousands of roofs in which people can hide with these kinds of weapons. And you can have, you can have the best intelligence you can have and simply not be able to find out whether someone is there with one of these weapons or whether one of these weapons has been smuggled into the country. It's just taking too much of a chance. When you consider the enormous economic impact on this country of one or two successful attacks with missiles against civil aviation, the consequences sociologically as well as economically are really difficult to comprehend. Now, the cost of fitting the civil aviation fleet with these countermeasures is indeed very high. Whether you'd have to fit the whole civil aviation fleet with these weapons is another, with these countermeasures is really another story. You said, well, there are 7,000 airplanes that carry passengers throughout the country and that take off from this country and go overseas. Well, that's 7,000 aircraft that might have to be fitted with systems that cost between $1 and $2 million. Even then, of course, it's a lot of money, but against the economic impact, the potential economic impact of a successful attack, I think, this cost is really, it's got to be viewed as acceptable.
We're speaking with Stephen Simon. His book is The Age of Sacred Terror, and with Michael Scardeville of the Heritage Foundation about spending on homeland security, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And our next caller is Andrew, who joins us from Plattsburgh, New York.
Hello there.
Hi.
Plattsburgh, New York, on beautiful Lake Champlain. I'm a Canadian citizen now residing in Plattsburgh, which is just 20 miles south of the border. And I have a few issues. probably take up too much of your time. I notice that going into Canada, the Canadian Customs, whether I travel with Americans or Canadians, Canada Customs is still asking if you've bought some minor gifts. I feel that they're not taking this seriously. At least that's the view I get when I cross the border. They seem so amateurish. There was some talk last year about the fact that they man the customs booths in the summer with students, and that's entirely true. They're amateurs. It's quite obvious. I also recently traveled to Montreal. There's a huge new convention center just opened called the Palais de Congrès, and I was walking around with a lunch pail attending a motorcycle show, and nobody questioned what was in this pail. You'd suspect somebody wanted to know what's in a backpack in a school. Well, here I am at a large meeting, and walking around seemed to be that no one was concerned, or they were shy to ask, afraid to ask. It seems that Montreal in the past has been a jumping-off point for terrorists, possibly because there's a French-speaking population, for whatever the reason is, the proximity to New York City. And lastly, there was a report several weeks ago about a government agency that was crossing back and forth across the border with improper papers, forged papers, walking across the border, and I never heard a follow-up or read a follow-up about that. Mm-hmm.
Michael Scardeville, border security has certainly been a point of emphasis and a lot of people say a big hole.
Well, there has been cases in the past where terrorists have used both the weak immigration and visa systems both in the United States and in Canada to get into both of our societies. Canada, they have a slightly easier time because of some of their asylum laws than they do even in the lax American system. However, I think in the post-9/11 era, Secretary of Homeland Security Tom Ridge and Minister Manley, his counterpart in Canada, have done a good job of trying to strike the appropriate balance of providing security and free movement of people and goods on the border. What I would really like to see is for them to change their focus from our shared northern border, allow that to remain largely an open border, and focus on making it difficult for people who may present a threat or products that may be able to be used by terrorists to cause harm in either of our countries from getting into either of our countries. Basically, instead of taking a traditional border security approach, take a hemispheric security approach. And I think that that's the direction that this relationship should be taking in the future. And that for the long term, or even the medium term, we're probably focusing a little bit too much attention on our shared territory, which will be virtually impossible to completely secure.
It's a very long border, and there's always going to be places you can walk across it.
There was just a report a couple days ago on the radio where a helicopter was hovering on the Vermont side of the Quebec-Vermont border, dropping bales of marijuana. What's a helicopter doing up in the air without appropriate clearance? It makes you think that they could fly in from a ship offshore, whether into Canada or the States.
Andrew, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
At the moment, we're speaking with Stephen Simon, a co-author of The Sacred Age of Terror. He's with the RAND Corporation, and Michael Scardeville, a Homeland Security Policy Analyst at the Heritage Foundation, about spending on Homeland Security, and we're taking your calls. Our next caller is Ed, who joins us from Louisville, Kentucky.
Greetings, gentlemen. As a former U.S. Marine, I was in Desert Storm 1, and I took very seriously the threat of nerve gas and mustard gas, and we were outfitted with suits. After surviving those attacks through the minefield belt, when I came home, I instantly bought my own gas mask, my own chemical warfare suits, and my four boys and my wife and I all have chemical warfare suits. I myself and my oldest boys drive around with firearms in our trucks, and we take securing our own perimeter very seriously. And I think if each American, instead of sitting back and saying, gosh, protect me, government, and takes responsibility for their own actions and their own safety by providing themselves with water and foods in their vehicles, protective gear, which is available to civilian individuals. I mean, the Second Amendment was perfectly crafted for this. This is the reason the forefathers put the Second Amendment into place, which was the right of the populace to keep and bear arms to protect the country from an outside threat or a threat that has infiltrated that needs to be watched. And I really feel I'm going to sit back and listen to you fellows, but this perimeter is secure. My family's all been trained in firearms, nuclear biological chemical response, and first aid during those attacks. And it's very simple to train people, and it's very easy to provide them with the resources to go get this stuff with their own money. Thanks for your time, and I'll listen on the radio.
Thanks for the call, Ed. Stephen Simon, how much of the responsibilities is ours as citizens?
Well, look, my view is that this is a national problem, and it's a problem that really only the U.S. government can tackle. Now, the U.S. government can't do this without the cooperation of the private sector. The adversary wants to target America's infrastructure and wants to target us here at home. The fact is that 95% of the infrastructure in this country is owned by the private sector, and it's going to be very difficult for the U.S. government successfully to defend it unless it has the cooperation of the private sector. This is going to be a very difficult thing to negotiate, precisely because the private sector and most Americans see the defense against this sort of attack as the responsibility of the U.S. government, as a national security problem. So this is, you know, there is an adjustment of perceptions that's going to have to come about before we really rationalize our response to this threat and get our best possible defense in place. Now, private Americans can try, as the caller said, to secure their perimeters one way or another, and if that works for them, that's admirable. I think that most Americans simply can't do that and can't be expected to do that, nor will this type of point defense, so to speak, be useful in preventing the threat from reaching us and inserting itself into our country. That is fundamentally a responsibility of the U.S. government in cooperation with its friends and allies overseas.
And Michael Scardeville, I wanted to read to you an email we got from Christopher Roseborough. I wonder, he writes, at the actual commitment and priorities of the Congress to fund Homeland Security, cities, towns, and villages, which would provide the frontline troops, i.e. firefighters, police officers, etc., in the event of a terrorist attack, have not received the funds necessary to provide for the equipment and training to counteract such an event. He goes on to say, members of Congress placed money into the omnibus budget bill to provide the Cowgirl Hall of Fame, a pork barrel contribution that funds Spanish language, other things. Why can't the Congress get its priorities straight and control themselves?
Well, both your last caller and your most recent email listener make very good points. I think your caller was probably one of the best prepared Americans I've ever heard comment. And I think he's right that there is a role for the average American to play here and to take some responsibility in providing for their families and themselves in the event of a disaster. Almost every American does this if they live in an area that's prone to hurricanes or snowstorms or earthquakes, and it should be no different from terrorism. When it comes to the issue of better preparing our first responders, our firefighters, our EMS departments, our police departments, and our public health sector, there is a need for some federal assistance to these people to gain specialized training, to develop interoperability programs, as well as mutual assistance agreements. And the Congress provided the number the president wanted, $3.5 billion for that purpose in the year 2003. Unfortunately, they micromanaged it through earmarking the vast majority of it. They took $1 billion of it and gave that to the president to use in a very flexible manner. But $1.5 billion was earmarked for traditional law enforcement grants, things to have like your local community policing and have, you know, cops just walking around making sure children are walking to school, not particularly Homeland Security related. And they claimed that that was Homeland Security. And then the remaining $1 billion they took and micromanaged how the federal government can spend it on legitimate purposes, things like interoperable radios, but they clearly delineated how much can be spent on what. However, every state, every city, every community has different needs, and the Bush administration should have a flexible grant program so they can tailor what money they give to the states based on those localities' needs. And absent that kind of reform of the federal grant program, no matter how much you give, it's not going to be as effective as it should be. So our first step should be reforming that grant program, making it into a lump sum $3.5 billion that the Department of Homeland Security can distribute based on the needs of every state. Then, after 6 months, we should evaluate whether $3.5 billion was enough. If it was, we can stay at that level for a while. If not, the president can ask for a supplemental. Then the department should be responsible for reassessing that amount every year thereafter in order to ensure that the needs of our firefighters and our police department and our public health sector are met.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there, but I wanted to thank you very much, both of you. Michael Scardeville, who you just heard, Homeland Security Policy Analyst at the Heritage Foundation, appreciate it. And Stephen Simon, good of you to join us today.
Thanks.
Stephen Simon, co-author of The Sacred Age of Terror, and he was with us from his office at the Rand Corporation.